appreciation for our precious human life and the opportunity that we have to encounter the Buddha's teachings and to listen to them and also to practice them. And let's make a strong determination to really use our lives in a meaningful way. The most meaningful way being to cultivate the bodhicitta, the aspiration for full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. So let's make that our motivation for sharing the Dharma together this evening. Okay. So last time, we were talking about the qualities of the Buddha. We talked about the four fearlessnesses, and we started on the 10 powers of the Tathagata. The thing is that my recorder ran out of batteries midway through the qualities of the Buddha. So I thought that we would review them this evening so that at least maybe one day if somebody listens to the recording, they will have the whole teaching. And reviewing never hurts us at all, does it? Okay, so if we go back and look at the four fearlessnesses that Chandrakirti talked about in his supplement to the Middle Way, and that we also find in the Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar Sutra in the Pali Canon. And somebody had written in and asked where it's possible to receive a copy of that sutra. And if you look in the book Majjhima Nikaya, or the Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha, it's published by Wisdom Publications and translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, then it's sutra number 12 in that volume, so you can read it there. It's really quite a lovely sutra. Okay, so let's just review the four kinds of intrepidity, or the four fearlessnesses of the Buddha. So the first one was the fearlessness, or the full confidence the Buddha has in proclaiming that he is enlightened with respect to all things. Okay, so that, you know, it's not that he's only enlightened with respect to a few and not respect to others, and so on and so forth, but he fully knows all phenomena that exist. And that is because of having purified the mind, because the mind has the natural ability to reflect and perceive and engage in objects. So when it's fully purified, then there's no hindrance to that. And then the second quality, or the second fearlessness, is that the Buddha is fearless in stating that he has destroyed all the taints or all the contaminations from the mind. So again, it isn't that he's just removed some and not others, and you know, but the mind is fully purified. And then the third one is the Buddha is fearless in terms of discerning what are the obstructions to be eliminated. Okay, so he knows exactly, you know, what is to be cultivated on the path, what is to be abandoned, what are the obstructions that prevent us from attaining liberation, what are the obstructions from preventing us from attaining full enlightenment, and so he's fearless in proclaiming those. And then the fourth fearlessness of the Buddha is he's fearless in knowing that if people practice the Dharma that he teaches, that it will lead them to the end of all suffering. Okay, so he has full confidence in what he's teaching. If you happen to be looking for the four fearlessnesses in the text by the third Dalai Lama, they're not in there. Okay? That's because we're going through the section on refuge, taking refuge in the essence of refined gold, and I'm bringing in some other material from some other texts that aren't listed there. So that's why you can't find it if you've been listening. Okay, so of these four fearlessnesses, the first two are related to what's called one's own purpose or one's own welfare. In this case, it means the Buddha's purpose or his welfare. And so it's pertaining, you know, in terms of the Buddha's enlightenment, he knows that he's eliminated all taints and has is fully enlightened with respect to all things. So that's, he's confident in terms of his own realization. And then the last two are related to the welfare of others, because those are the two ways, or are two of the ways, I should say, in which the Buddha benefits others. So he does it by, you know, being able to state what are the obstructions, you know, what needs to be eliminated, and also by teaching the Dharma and knowing that if people practice what he teaches, that they'll be able to attain nirvana. And so those two are related to, you know, the purpose of others, how he benefits others. Okay, remember we talked a little bit last time about purpose of self and purpose of others? You don't remember? Well, what to do? Okay, then I also wanted to talk a little bit about the 10 powers of the Tathagata. The Tathagata is a Sanskrit word, it's also a Pali word. It means the one that's gone, so it means that the Buddha has gone to the end of the path, he's gone to the realization of the ultimate nature of all phenomena. So these 10 powers are found, you know, in the Greater Discourse and the Lion's Roar Sutra. So that's in the Pali Canon, but they're also spoken of in the Sanskrit tradition. Okay? And so these 10 are what enabled the Buddha to roar his lion's roar of full enlightenment. In other words, to have the qualities of a fully enlightened being. So we'll kind of go through these 10, and it's very interesting to contemplate them. These were some of the suggestions I gave for your meditation after the last teaching, was to just think of, you know, well, what would it be like to have these qualities? And just in the process of imagining them, then you begin to see how, you know, what kind of outstanding qualities a fully enlightened Buddha is. And that gives us so much more trust and confidence in the Buddha as our spiritual guide. And trust or confidence is one of the causes of taking refuge. So the more we understand the qualities of the objects of refuge, the more faith or confidence we have, and the deeper our refuge becomes. Okay, so going to the 10 powers of a Tathagata. Okay, so the Tathagata understands as it actually is, the possible as possible and the impossible as impossible. Okay, this is a very useful skill. So as it is explained according to one of the Pali commentaries, it means that the Buddha understands that it's impossible for somebody who has right view to consider the conditioned phenomena of samsara as permanent and as pleasurable and as having a self, and it's impossible for such a person with right view to think that way, and it is also possible for somebody who lacks the right view to consider all the conditioned phenomena of samsara as permanent, as pleasurable, and as having some kind of self-nature. Okay. It's also impossible, the Buddha knows that it's impossible for somebody who has right view to commit any of the 5 heinous actions, such as killing one's mother, one's father, or an arhat, or shedding the blood of a Buddha, or causing disharmony or schism in a Sangha community. So they know that that's impossible. The Buddha also knows that it's impossible for suffering to be produced from good karma and from for happiness to be produced from negative karma. Okay? And then in the Sanskrit tradition, it takes this a little, you know, really emphasizes this thing about karma and says that the Buddha knows with direct, unmistaken perception the appropriate and inappropriate relations between actions and their effects. Okay? So what kinds of things cause happiness, what kinds of things cause suffering, When you have happiness, what kinds of actions produce it? When we have suffering, what kinds of actions produce that? Okay, and so because the Buddha knows this due to, you know, direct perception, not through conceptual knowledge, not through something that he's made up, but because he has the clairvoyant powers to see it, then when the Buddha discusses karma and what are the results of different actions, then we can trust that, and we should kind of wake up when we listen to things. You know, because lots of times you hear people say, oh, well, the Buddha was talking about karma, and he says that's bad karma and all the bad results that come from it, because he's just trying to scare all these people. You know, he's talking to all these ignorant people who are nomads, you know, or farmers, so he's just trying to scare them, but he doesn't really mean it. Well, I think you might be on a little shaky ground saying that, okay? Because if the Buddha has these kinds of powers and abilities to see with direct perception, then I don't think he would exaggerate or lie, you know? I mean, it doesn't do him any good to exaggerate or, you know, in any way. And in fact, when he's teaching about karma, he's, you know, doing it for our benefit. We do have to realize that when some of the statements about karma and their effects, sometimes they might seem like really, you know, they might seem like, whoa, you get a big result from a small cause. But we should remember that if that's the case for, you know, harmful actions, it's also going to be the case for constructive actions. Yeah, so don't think that you just get big results from a small action in the case of negative actions, but for positive actions it doesn't happen that way. You have to work really, really hard. No, it's not the same. We have, you know, it's a parallel thing that karma is increasing. Okay, then the second power of a Tathagata is that the enlightened beings understand, as it actually is, the results of actions undertaken past, future, and present with possibilities and with causes. Okay, so only the Buddha knows fully and accurately the intricacies of karma and its results. And he, you know, if we were to ask, let's say, why are those of us who are on this teleteaching call, today, what's the date, May 8th, you know, in 2007, how did we all create the karma to be here listening to this call? Well, you know, you really have to have some incredible clarity of mind and clairvoyant powers to be able to know that. But the Buddha, in the case of each one of us, would be able to look and know all the different past actions that led each one of us individually to be here listening to this teaching tonight. Because it wasn't just one past action that, you know, enabled us to listen to it. It's like a whole multitude, because first we had to get a precious human life, so that's due to a whole bunch of different actions, and then, you know, all the actions that cause us to be living where we're living and to have encountered each other in the Dharma and to have, you know, the time and ability and so on, you know, to listening to the teachings tonight. So the Buddha would be able to know all of that. Okay, then the third power of the Buddha is that Tathagata understands, as it actually is, the ways leading to all destinations. Okay, so what this means is that the Buddha has full knowledge of all the six realms of rebirth in samsara and the path leading to that rebirth. So the path leading to that rebirth, that means the karma, the kinds of actions that we do that bring the result of those different kinds of rebirth. And the Buddha also knows nirvana and the path leading to that. Okay, so this really makes the Buddha a good guide, because he knows, you know, he's able to describe very clearly, you know, what leads to rebirth and what kind of realm. So if we're looking for rebirth in a particular realm, the Buddha can tell us exactly what kind of causes to create to receive that rebirth. And he can also say what kind of causes we need to create if we aspire for nirvana or for full enlightenment. He also knows all the incorrect paths that lead us to continual rebirth in samsara. Okay, and he knows the correct path leading to the enlightenment of the three vehicles. So this is according to the Sanskrit tradition, because in the Sanskrit tradition we talk about the three vehicles: the hearer vehicle, the pratyeka vehicle, or the solitary realizer vehicle, and the bodhisattva vehicle. So both the hearers and the solitary realizers, they are aspiring for liberation from cyclic existence, or arhatship. And whereas somebody on the bodhisattva vehicle wishes to attain full enlightenment. So a Buddha knows all the paths that lead to, you know, the nirvana of an arhat, the nirvana of a solitary realizer, the nirvana of a bodhisattva. Okay? The hearer arhats, that first vehicle, they're called hearers because they have heard the Buddha teach and they practice it. They don't necessarily practice the bodhisattva teachings that they hear, but they practice what is necessary to attain the arhatship of a hearer. And they also teach. They listen, they hear the teachings, and they also give them. So it could be sometimes that a hearer may give a bodhisattva teaching, but they don't necessarily practice it. So it's their emphasis is on hearing. So it's called the hearer vehicle. Then the solitary realizer vehicle is so called because people who follow that vehicle in the last lifetime, in the lifetime in which they attain arhatship, then they are born in at a historical period where a Buddha has not appeared on the earth. And so they practice, according to all the teachings that they learned in their previous life, attain arhatship. And then it's said that they teach sometimes by making gestures and things like that, so not always in really obvious ways. Mm-hmm. And then the third vehicle, the bodhisattva vehicle, is so called because these beings aspire for the full enlightenment, because their heart is really set on and determined to benefit all the sentient beings. Okay? And so they want to attain full enlightenment in order to have the full capability to be able to benefit everyone in the greatest and most effective way. So they're called bodhisattvas, and that's the bodhisattva vehicle. Now, I can just hear somebody saying, well, wait a minute, what about Vajrayana? Isn't that a vehicle? Yeah? I mean, sometimes we hear Hinayana and Mahayana and Vajrayana. I mean, you hear this all the time in America. People are saying, oh yes, there's three vehicles, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. And then they say, oh, well, these people practice Hinayana teachings, and then if you practice Pure Land or Zen, you practice Mahayana teachings, and if you practice Tibetan Buddhism, you practice Vajrayana teachings. Actually, all that is a very big misunderstanding. First of all, I think that the term Hinayana is outdated, and what His Holiness uses now is the fundamental vehicle. In other words, the teachings in the Pali tradition form the foundation for all future Buddhist practice, and they are to be practiced by everybody. Okay. Then the Mahayana is the vehicle leading to full enlightenment, and it has different branches. Okay, sometimes we can talk of two branches, the Paramitayana and the Vajrayana. Okay, those are both subcategories of the Mahayana. The Paramitayana means the perfection vehicle, and that means that you practice to attain full enlightenment by practicing the six perfections or the six far-reaching attitudes. Okay, so that's the regular practice of a bodhisattva. Then the Vajrayana is you attain full enlightenment by practicing the doing the practices of the four stages of Tantra. Okay, now here you see, yeah, that the Hinayana should actually be called the fundamental vehicle. There are all the foundation teachings which everybody must practice. Okay, you may not have the particular aspiration for enlightenment, for nirvana, for your own benefit, but the other teachings you practice. So even if you're practicing Mahayana, you also have to do the practices of the fundamental vehicle. Okay, so it isn't like Mahayana is a whole different set of practices that's totally unrelated. No, you know, if you look and you know the Dharma well, you see that so many of the what's called Mahayana teachings are like very firmly rooted in you know, the Theravada practice and in the practice as spoken of in the Pali Canon. Okay? And if you look in the Chinese canon and the Tibetan canon, which are both said to be Mahayana countries, okay, they both have a lot of sutras within their canons that are from the fundamental vehicle. Okay? So it's not a whole different set. The true, you know, the Chinese and Tibetan canons have a lot of Mahayana sutras that you don't find in the Pali canon, but they have a lot of the Pali sutras in the Mahayana canon. Canons, and I should say in the Chinese canon and the Tibetan canon. Then also with the Vajrayana, to practice Vajrayana, first of all, Vajrayana is a sub-branch of Mahayana. It's not a different tradition. It's a sub-branch of it. Okay, one of the sub-branches was practicing the six perfections. Another sub-branch is practicing doing the tantric teachings. If you're going to do the tantric teachings, then you have to do the practice of the fundamental vehicle, and you also have to do the practices of the six far-reaching attitudes that are part of the perfection vehicle. And on that basis, then you take Vajrayana initiation and do that practice. And I really emphasize this because so often in Buddhism in America, people talk about Vajrayana as if it's something totally unrelated. You know, it's like, oh, they don't do any fundamental vehicle practice. They don't do any Mahayana practice. They just do Tantra. That's totally wrong, you know. And if you practice in Tibetan Buddhism, you find the teachings in the fundamental vehicle. You find the teachings in the general Mahayana, in the perfection vehicle. And you find the teachings of the Vajrayana. So all three of those are practiced in Tibetan Buddhism. And I think that's really important for people to understand, just because there's so much rampant misunderstanding, you know. Mm. You know, sometimes even I go to conferences of, you know, Buddhist teachers and things, and people talk like that, and it's like, huh? You know, it's we don't talk like that. Okay, so that was I got off on a tangent there, but hopefully that's useful for you. Clear up some misunderstanding. Okay, so that was the third one that the Tathagata understands as it actually is the ways leading to all destinations, okay? So leading to rebirth in the six realms and the past leading to nirvana, okay? So the nirvana of a hearer, of a solitary realizer, and of a bodhisattva practitioner. Okay, then the fourth one is the Tathagata understands that it actually is the world with its many and different elements. Okay, so in the Pali Canon, there's a sutta called the Sutta of the Many Kinds of Elements. And here the Buddha talks about the 18 elements, okay, and then the six elements of earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. Nagarjuna also talks about those. He talks about the external and internal sense bases and the 12 links of dependent origination and so on. Okay, in the Sanskrit tradition, they talk about the 22 powers or elements or powers or faculties, and these contain all those different elements. And I believe this list of 22 is also found in the Pali tradition. So these are different categories of phenomena. And if you're scratching your head and going, well, what are the 18 elements and what are the 6 elements and what are the external and internal sense bases and all of these things, well, meditating on them just happens to be one of the antidotes to pride. Why? Because there's so much to understand, and these things are not simple at all. Okay, so you meditate on them when you want to get rid of your pride, because they leave you scratching your head. Okay. Then the fifth power of the Tathagata is that a Tathagata understands, as it actually is, how beings have different inclinations or aspirations. So, you know, if we look at all the various sentient beings, people have so many different inclinations and aspirations, don't they? Yeah? Some, just in a common level, some people like noodles and some people like rice and, you know, so there's different inclinations there. But on a spiritual level as well, some people feel more comfortable believing in a creator deity. You know, other people do not. Some people aspire for liberation, others for enlightenment. Some people aspire to be born in heaven. Some people aspire for a good rebirth. Okay, so there's so many different kinds of inclinations. Some people, you know, aspire or inclined towards the hearer vehicle, some towards the solitary realizer vehicle, some towards the bodhisattva vehicle. Okay, so by knowing all these different inclinations and aspirations of sentient beings, then a Buddha is able to guide us better. Okay, because he knows kind of, you know, sometimes we're not so clear on what our own dispositions are, what our own interests are. But the Buddha is able to tell us to know that, you know, through his powers, his mental powers, and therefore he uses that understanding in order to teach us, you know, what is most effective for our present state of mind. And so that's why we see that the Buddha, you know, gave such a wide variety of teachings. You know, he didn't just give one teaching and, you know, every time he spoke. There's so many different kinds of teachings. And he did that, you know, according to the audience and the disposition of the people in the audience. Then the sixth power of the Buddha is the Tathagata understands, as it actually is, the dispositions of the faculties of other beings, of other persons. Okay? So, in the Pali tradition, they say that this refers to the Buddha's knowledge of either the development or the lack of development of various sentient beings' faculties of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, so those five are in the 37 harmonies with enlightenment are, you know, the five faculties, and they're also called the five powers. And so the Buddha is able to tell, you know, to what extent everybody has developed those five, and therefore teach them accordingly. You know, not teach something that's too difficult for somebody or too simple for somebody or some, you know, whatever. The Sanskrit tradition describes this one as the Buddha's knowledge of the various kinds of dispositions of sentient beings. So, some, you know, here that you might wonder, well, what's the difference between an inclination and aspiration on one hand and a disposition on the other. So some people might have a certain inclination or aspiration, but they may lack the disposition or the nature to be able to benefit from it or to attain it. Okay, so knowing these different faculties, these different dispositions, the Tibetan word for disposition is kam or rig, and that's the same kind of Tibetan term that they use when they talk about the Buddha nature. Okay, and so some traditions talk about some people have the nature to attain a hearer arhatship, you know, or some people have the nature to have a solitary realize her arhatship, or bodhisattva enlightenment, something like that. Okay, so the Buddha, what we're getting at here is that the Buddha understands us better than we understand ourselves, which is a really good thing, because we don't understand ourselves so well, do we? And because the Buddha understands us so well, then he's able to teach accordingly, and to know what we need to hear at what particular times in order to guide us most effectively. Then the seventh faculty, or the seventh of the ten powers of the Buddha, is the Tathagata understands as it actually is the defilement, the cleansing, and the emergence in regard to the jhanas, liberations, concentrations, and meditative absorptions. Okay. So, the Buddha understands the defilement, cleansing, and emergence of these different kinds of meditative states. So the defilement means, you know, something that's causing deterioration. The cleansing is, you know, what you do to attain excellence in it. And the emergence is talking about both attaining and rising out of these different meditative absorptions. Okay, so the Buddha talked about, knowing all this in relationship to the jhanas. So the jhanas are the four states of concentration in the form realm. Okay, they're just called first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Jhana is the Pali word, and the Sanskrit word is dhyana. So, you know, when you hear about the five dhyana Buddhas, that's the word dhyana comes from. Okay, and in Chinese, that word is translated as chan, and in Japanese, it is zen. Okay, and so it's referring to states of concentration. Yeah, so jhana, dhyana, chan, and zen, yeah, are all referring to quite particularly, you know, these four states of concentration, but in general, other states of meditation as well. Okay, so when we are gaining single-pointed concentration, you know, then you practice, and when you're, there's a whole description of the levels that you go through, you know, but when you are in the first state of deep concentration, that's called the first jhana, and then so on, you progress through the first, second, third, and fourth. Okay, then the liberations. Okay, these are called, they're called the eight liberations, and these are different states of meditative absorption. I won't list them out because you might get a little bit confused, but they're, leave it, just we'll say that there's other states of liberation. If you're interested, let me know and I can go through them. And then the Buddha also knows all about the nine meditative absorptions, okay? And so these are talking about the four jhanas and the four formless absorptions, and then the cessation of discrimination and feeling, which is another kind of meditative absorption for the non-returners. Okay, so this also, you know, by knowing all of this, the Buddha knows what are the causes and conditions for being able to attain all these various states of meditative absorption. And he also knows which states of meditative absorption are conducive for gaining what kind of realization, and which ones, in, you know, because some of these meditative absorptions are so kind of blissful that you just get totally spaced out in them and you never develop insight. So he also knows, you know, which ones you can get so blissed out on that you actually wind up staying in samsara longer than you need to. And the Buddha has actualized all these different states of meditative absorption himself, and so he can speak on how to develop them from his own experience. Yeah, it isn't like somebody who made something up and is marketing it in the local New Age newspaper. Okay, so he knows, you know, who gets attached to the bliss of meditative absorption, and he can counsel them, you know, so that he reduces their attachment and keeps them on the path to liberation, and then, you know, and urges them to continue practicing the path of wisdom and compassion. And then he also knows, you know, these various states of absorption and how to attain them, and so he can teach all of us whose minds are like all over the place, you know. I don't know about yours, but my mind is completely all over the place. Then he knows all the methods to teach us how to develop some single pointedness. Okay, then the eighth power of the Buddha. This one is, I'll read again from the Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar. It's a little bit longer of a paragraph, but it's quite nice. It gives you some idea of how the original sutras speak. So the eighth one says, the Tathagata recollects his manifold past lives. That is, one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many eons of world contraction, when many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. So of all, in all his rebirths, in all of these, you know, eons, then he knows, there I was named so-and-so, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, so what the kind of food that he ate, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, in other words, lifespan, my passing away from there, I reappeared elsewhere, and there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared here. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, he recollects his manifold past lives. Okay? So just think about that a minute, yeah? Knowing all of your past lives as clearly as we see something in the palm of our hand. And knowing, you know, what was your name, what kind of food you ate, what your lifespan was, what experiences of happiness you had, what experiences of suffering you had, what you looked like, what you did, everything, you know, kind of knowing all of that from one's own previous life. So this is attained through very deep states of samadhi. And I think it must require a lot of courage, a very particular strength of mind to be able to remember our previous lives. Not just the strength of the samadhi to remember them, you know, to perceive them, but a strength of mind to bear what we see we have been and done in a previous life. Because, you know, we all like to think, you know, oh, I was Cleopatra. You know, I mean, you go to these kinds of rebirthing things where people remember their previous rebirths. You know, everybody remembers being Cleopatra, being waited on. Nobody remembers being the people that Cleopatra killed, you know, or had killed or anything like that. Nobody remembers being Cleopatra's servant, you know, and emptying her latrine. So, you know, but if you think about it, we've been everything, done everything in cyclic existence. So, you know, if we remember our previous rebirths, we might remember ourselves doing really horrible, cruel, you know, disgusting things. So I think it takes a certain amount of internal mental strength and probably compassion for ourselves and realization of emptiness, so that we don't grab on to some inherently existent I as the one who did all of those things, you know. Cause so if you really want to perceive your previous rebirths, you know, kind of better be sure that you're prepared to do that, you know, because it's not all Cleopatra. Okay, the fact that the Buddha knows, you know, this gives him the ability to know who he has what kind of relationships with from a previous life. You know, because we always talk about karma connections. You know, in Chinese Buddhism, or in Chinese culture, there's a special word for connection, you know, when you have a connection with somebody. And so, you know, we have different kinds of connections with different kinds of people. And these are not something that are permanent and fast and solid. They're conditioned phenomena, you know, and they're conditioned by the kinds of actions that we did in the past. Okay, so we have, you know, who our family members are, what kind of Dharma teachers we feel attracted to, you know, what kind of groups we belong to, and what our friendships are. So these kind of karmic connections are conditioned phenomena. We can see even this life we're that we're doing things that are conditioning what our future relationships are to be, and what our present relationships are, you know, conditioned by actions and relationships in a previous life. So by knowing that, then the Buddha kind of knows, or any particular Buddha may know, you know, in what way to relate to different sentient beings, and what way they can relate to them, or what kind of manifestation they can appear to any particular sentient being to best benefit that being. Okay? This ability to recollect one's previous rebirths for such a long time, this is one of the five supernormal powers that they often talk about. And then also when they talk about the three higher knowledges that the Buddha developed on the night of his enlightenment, this is in the Pali Canon, they speak of the three higher knowledges. This is the first one. So when Buddha sat down under the Bodhi tree, as the story goes, this is the first realization that he had, was of, you know, all of his previous lives. Okay, then the ninth power is, this is also one of the five supernormal powers, and this is the second higher knowledge that the Buddha gained on, you know, while he was meditating the evening before he attained enlightenment. So this is the power of the divine eye. And so I'll read the whole passage here from the sutra, how they describe this power of the Buddha. So it says, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human. I should say divine eye, it doesn't mean like a physical eye at all. It means mental clairvoyance. So with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, the Tathagata sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. He understands how beings pass on according to their actions. Thus, these worthy beings who were ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, revilers of noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, they have appeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination, in perdition, even in hell. But these worthy beings who were well conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers of noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, they have appeared in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And he understands how beings pass on according to their actions, the karma. Okay, so here what this means is that through the purity of his mind, the Buddha is able to see accurately through mental consciousness, not through our consciousness, how beings die, so the different beings, how we die, how we are reborn according to our karma. Okay, so this full knowledge of karma, how beings die, how they're reborn, you know, so being able to look at any one of us, know what we were in a previous life, what causes we created, you know, how we died, how we were reborn as who we are now, how we're going to die and be reborn. Okay, and so knowing all of this gives the Buddha the ability to manifest in whatever form best suits us. Because, you know, he knows what our karma is, how we die, how we're reborn. And so having all these abilities to manifest many bodies, then the Buddha can manifest in whatever form is most suitable for us due to this divine eye ability. He knows what to manifest as. Okay, and then the tenth power of the Buddha, again reading from the sutra, it says, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, the Tathagata here and now enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of taints. Okay, so it's said that for beings who are not Buddhas, that, you know, like the higher level bodhisattvas or those on the here and solitary realizer path, or even people who have developed different levels of meditative absorption, that they can only know clairvoyantly the level of realization on somebody who's of their same level of or of a lower level. So they can't, cyclically know the level of realization of somebody who has a greater level of realization. So only a fully enlightened Buddha is capable of knowing the levels and attainments of each and every sentient being. So he's not fooled by all of our pretentiousness, how we like to pretend that we're further along the path than we are, and he's not fooled when we get into a low self-esteem, self-degradation trip either. But he knows exactly where we're at, what we've understood, what we haven't understood. And then this too gives the Buddha a special ability to know how to guide us on the path. Okay, so those are the 10 powers of the Tathagata. Okay, and, you know, again, when you reflect on them, just, you know, think about what it would be like to have these abilities and, you know, what it must be like to be a Buddha with this kind of clarified mind and be able to extend such incredible benefit to others, principally by leading us along the path to enlightenment. Okay, so that's for your meditation after the teaching.